Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwinninger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing, subscribe to our podcast, leave us a lovely five-star review, and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk more about cybersecurity. In each episode, we'll focus on a specific topic or two of interest to the community. Today, we're talking about the COFENS annual State of Email Security Report for 2023.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And the state of email security is Ohio.
Well, that was easy enough. Thank you all for joining us today. And
Mic drop.
I don't know. This might cost me money.
They crammed Ohio over 25 pages. So
that's really, really big font. So the annual 2023 annual state of email security reports, annual.
Is that annually?
Let us be about the business. About the business, let us be. So my summary of it is mo money, mo bad guys.
Moses lack.
I didn't feel like there was anything especially new or astounding in here.
No, I thought what I found most interesting is the comments they had about the email gateways, which we'll get to.
That was new. Yeah. So there was something new in here, but yeah, a lot of their talk about what's big, what's getting worse, what's getting better is all stuff we've seen everywhere else, which makes me wonder about the value in producing a report like this. If you can't say anything unique, or I guess the value is some VP decided that we have to produce an annual report.
Well, I think, you know, the position that COFENS is in, they've got a lot of data and a lot of statistics. So you want to be able to learn something from that data. And if you go through the process of reviewing the data and coming up with, you know, summarizing or whatever, and then come out with the answer of, you know, the same today as it was yesterday, how do you justify all that work you just did in the statistical analysis of the data you've been collecting?
Yeah, that can be rough. Like, we've got all this data, and dang it, why won't the bad guys do something? It's like that meme or whatever where they're poking something with a stick, being like, come on, do something.
I don't think I've seen that one.
Oh, yeah, they're in this case, they're poking the hackers with a stick. Come on, do something fun. All right, we can work our way through. So in the summary, the executive summary, this is actually before the executive summary in there. They start off with a introduction from the letter from the CISO.
And the only thing I didn't even read that.
I didn't even read that. All right. Well, the only thing in here that was interesting where they said, have you followed the trend of adding a cyber threat intelligence team? And we all know my feelings on threat intelligence. And I'm not sure that's really adding value here. It's fun. It's way more fun. I think doing threat intel seems way more fun than doing tickets and doing incidents, but I don't know that actually improves the response ability of your analysts.
It almost seems to me like she was conflating two things together, because they talk towards the end of the report about cyberhuman intelligence and, you know, the number of signals they get from humans in here. But they don't really mention threat intelligence per se outside of that context. And we'll get into that. Human intelligence stuff a bit later.
Yeah, she does say something at the top about adding more threat feeds isn't productive, and that's why they've stood firm on their human vetted intelligence.
Right, which means clicking the phishing button.
That's one of the things that I haven't actually quite figured out yet is how to develop better phishing intel based on who's actually hitting you. Because there may be groups that are specifically hitting your organization, but it's kind of buried in the generic phishing.
Well, I mean, because virtually every group does phishing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to do any kind of isolation with that.
Yeah. Yep. All right.
So, of course, they start off with the executive summary with threats of increase in frequency, intensity, and sophistication. So be terrified. Shocked. Be terrified. That's the bottom line of the executive summary.
I am. Can't you hear me shaking from over there?
Was like, even if that weren't true, they were kind of incentivized to say that because their whole point is to dream up business. But they don't come up with the opposite statement where, you know, defenders have gotten slower, lazier, and stupider either.
Can you imagine them putting that in a report? Oh my gosh.
That would be hilarious.
You know what, though? I tell you exactly who's going to put that in the report. The AI firms. Our AI analysts never stop working.
Our AI overlords.
Yeah, well, that's down the road. First, it's the AI analysts. Then it's the AI overlords.
But in the executive summary, they mentioned that just emails have increased by 569%. There's a 478% increase in the number of credential phishing-related active reports published. So I'm not sure that even is a terribly good metric.
Published?
So there was a 478% increase in the number of published reports. Mm-hmm. Does that actually reflect the number, is that 478% the best representation to show increased credential phishing when you're talking about the published reports versus simply, you know, the number of credential phishing emails that you see?
Is that an increase in compromises, or is it an increase in reports and threat intel folks trying to show value?
It's a dodgy number, I think.
I agree.
So they've seen a 44% increase in malware and a 626% year-over-year increase in emails detected and auto-quarantined from customers' inboxes worldwide.
All right. Do you know how Cofence auto-quarantine works?
If I understand it correctly, the way that it works is that based on previously by emails from other customers, they will reach in and pull emails out of mailboxes after it's already been delivered. Yep. Because the intel is received after the mail has been delivered.
Yep, yep.
So at the time of delivery, it was not known to be malicious by anybody.
Yeah.
And then Cofence figures out that's malicious and then reaches back in and grabs it.
Yep. And they can do that based on the URLs in the email, the sender of the email, the subject line. They've got a bunch of IOCs they look at, attachment hashes, et cetera.
Right. So that 626% increase is what got past the email gateway. So, you know, that could be an indicator of multiple different things, right? So there could be a lot more malicious emails being sent. The creators of malicious emails could be getting better at it. The email gateways could be stagnating or getting worse, or they could have onboarded more customers.
Yeah, because that is a year-over-year increase. That's not normalized in any way. Like, what's the percent increase in emails detected in auto-quarantine per employee that's covered by Cofence?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is all from what they said was 480,754 malicious emails, which were part of 255,863 campaigns.
That is a lower number of campaigns I would expect for that number of emails.
Well, I think you're just talking about averages, because I think, you know, you've got some one-offs in here with spear phishing, yeah. And they mentioned whaling.
That's why I wish that
mass
they would
campaigns.
I wish that they would take out the individual ones. I would assume the individual ones are a lot more interesting to them than the other ones.
But right. This would have been a more interesting number if they had said that, you know, there are 480 total malicious emails. 100,000 of these were spear phishing, where they only sent one email or something like that.
Yeah.
And these were campaigns comprised of five or more emails or something along those lines. That would have been interesting numbers to see. Which brings us to section one, which is the first section.
Hey, section one.
So to quote the paper, our goal is to contribute the phishing expertise necessary to turn humans around the world into the strongest link in the security chain, and to translate the resulting human effort into machine learning, phishing threat intelligence, and automated actions. So I mentioned that quote because I thought that was kind of interesting, the way that they put that. But it seems to indicate that they're using the reports from people clicking on the phishing buttons to feed some kind of ML model that they're using on the back end.
That would make sense. They get a lot of submitted emails. Trying to do each of those emails submitted via humans is tough. I don't know that they're, I don't know how much ML they're. I reviewed them a year ago or so. At the time, what I was told was that they were not using machine learning at the time. They were using a complicated series of Yara rules to pull out stuff. But it makes sense. Like, if they've got if they've got 35 million human reporters on, they probably could, they've got a really great data set, I guess is where I'm going with that.
Right. And so they call it the global network of 35 million human reporters. So I think that means that they have 35 million employees of their customers.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty decent sized chunk of folks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm actually surprised that the numbers are that low then, only less than 500,000 malicious emails.
Well, hold on. Remember, is that how many emails they detected, or is that how many emails they pulled?
The way that I read it was that was the total they saw, but I could have misread that.
They don't put anything in here about how many total emails were submitted, did they?
Well, from the figure on page 3, it says total malicious emails identified.
Yeah, but that's under figure 2, CoFence auto quarantine summary. That implies to me that that's how many were pulled. But yeah, you're right. It could be that they identified the malicious emails and then they pulled them based on auto quarantine below. Because if you look below each of those quarters, the top line's under 50,000. That implies that the last three quarters is 450,000 alone. Then 2022 Q1's over 100. Yeah, so those numbers don't match up.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, maybe they identified 480,000 and then they pulled the further ones below. I think this chart shows basically a zero in 2021 Q1, I bet that's when their service began being offered, or the auto quarantine at least.
That could be. But I think that gets into something that, you know, we'll get into a little bit later in some of the other stuff, is that these numbers they're not easily digested, because there's a picture they want to represent versus relaying the data in an easily consumed manner, which is what you'll usually get from vendor reports where they're trying to present a certain picture to folks. All right. And right after that, they get into the percentage of malicious emails missed by secure email gateways in 2022. And I thought this was one of the more interesting aspects of the entire report. So once you get the report, take a look at the table or the chart, which is presented on page 4, which is figure 3. And what this has a stacked bar chart with 7 email security gateway or email providers. And it breaks down each bar into 4 sections: BEC emails, credential phishing, malware, and threat unavailable. So I guess that's uncategorized maliciousness. And it shows the percentage of total, which falls into those 4 categories for either the email providers or the email gateways, which has eventually been caught or identified by CoFence. For instance, Cisco had 8% BEC, 60% credential phishing, 3% malware, and 29% threat unavailable. So of the total number of emails that got past a Cisco email gateway that CoFence then identified as malicious, 60% were credential phishing emails. Now, which you notice when you look across this chart is that most of the email providers or the secure email gateways come out to be pretty similar in their ability to deal with these different types of malicious email. You've got roughly 10% BEC, roughly 65 to 70% credential phishing, around 5% for malware, and then around 20% for threat unavailable in rough numbers. But there are 2 outliers here that are interesting to call out. Mimecast, which I'm not familiar with at all, the average for BEC for all the others is 7%, but Mimecast is 23%. So Mimecast seems to be particularly bad about preventing BEC from getting through.
Ouch.
Because that's over 300% worse than the other competitors in the market. And then Google, which this was pretty surprising to me. Google is terrible against malware. So the average malware that got through the gateways was 2.5%. But for Google, it was 11, which is 440% worse than the competitors. I would not have expected Google, who I can't even fathom the numbers of emails that Google is dealing with Gmail, it's got to be astronomical. And they're terrible at doing malware detection and prevention.
Yeah, that is interesting. I appreciate this. This should be something that everyone who's looking at a new email gateway is looking at, so they can kind of prioritize what they care more about. Because, for example, you mentioned Google is worse in terms of malware, but it's better for business email compromise. So, you know, trade off one way or the other.
Right. And maybe that's something you're willing to deal with, because it was the lowest of all of them for BEC at 5%. And as we've mentioned numerous times on this podcast, BEC is really what's eating everybody's lunch, even though ransomware gets the headlines.
Yeah, maybe you've got a really good EDR and you're not as worried about malware or create processes around that. And you really struggle with the BEC part. And then if you really struggle with the BEC part, you definitely don't want Mimecast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although the annoying thing about this, like a lot of their metrics have weird issues. Like, so for this one, what they did was they normalized it at 100% to compare proportions against each other, which is interesting and good. But I also would have liked to have seen the actual numbers. Like maybe Mimecast is worse at BEC, but it stripped out, maybe, you know, it only saw 10% of the numbers of email. It only passed 10% of the numbers of overall malicious emails compared to the others.
Right. So what they could have done, rather than putting the raw numbers in there, is break those seven up into a 100% chart. You know, a separate number says, of all the emails that have gotten past email gateways that have been seen by CoFence, you know, 10% of the total or 50% of the total was Google. And then this other one is only 5% or 6% versus putting the raw numbers in there.
Yeah.
So maybe that would have been a good way to show that.
Yeah, I would have really liked that. Although it occurred to me as I was saying it and after I was saying it, they probably don't have those numbers since this is CoFence. Like they don't. They're behind these gateways. They're probably able to see this because of the reported emails have some sort of setting that indicate what email gateway they went through. No, but you're right. They would have the number of reported emails, so they could give us the total numbers. They just couldn't give us the numbers of emails that were ignored. Like they couldn't give us like a
exactly.
Yeah. I just can't, because like with numbers like this, like, you know, maybe Mimecast passed 1% of. I don't know. I just don't like this display personally.
Right. Well, it's not that, like I said, I don't think the display is bad. I think the display is good, but I think what you're talking about is additional context would have been better or improved that chart if they could have broken that out.
Yeah. Always want more.
Because they could have also added another bar on the end that says everyone else and then average those numbers as well. Because I doubt that these are the only email gateways or providers they're seeing.
Yep.
But moving on in this section, the next part is what they call the top five highlights of the email security landscape. And the first one being credential phishing as the top attack vector. Yep. 478% increase. So there's a section in there that kind of, or a few paragraphs that actually dig into this, but an interesting quote that I pulled out of there was, while the password may have been reset, threat actor remains persistent in the inbox by adding auto-forwarding rules for keywords related to financial transactions, i.e. invoices, purchases, purchase orders, quotes, et cetera. And that got me thinking about how many, you know, after one of these, an event has happened where you've got a credential compromise or whatever, how often do responders go back and check the configurations around that user's account, including their email? Now, what have they set up any auto forwarding rules or anything like that within their configuration?
So this is one thing. This is one thing I do like about this report is that it brings it up to the people who haven't seen this before. Because when I was doing phishing, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I did not know about this. I was told after a phishing event, the IT group that was investigating it mentioned that there was a forwarding rule added that forwarded all their email to this external email address. So after that, I've definitely been doing it, but this was not something I knew about before that occurred.
Well, the thing is that whatever email solution you're using should be able to restrict or prevent those rules from being created by any user in order to prevent that kind of thing, unless they have an exception in place.
Yeah, but that's another case of, you know, the way things should be and the way things are actually done not matching.
Are you telling me that's not a perfect world out there, Matt?
Yeah. So I've seen a couple different forwarding rules set up or rules, email rules in general. So I've seen them forward all emails out to a third-party email address, almost always a Gmail address. I've never actually seen them forward only invoice related, but that makes more sense. Although if you're going to set up a forwarding rule for that, why not just forward everything? And then
what that boils down to is if they were able to target a specific user, you know, if they were targeting a financial person or, you know, yeah. I think they would have to have that intent ahead of time versus, you know, getting anybody and then doing the forward.
That's fair. And then I've seen rules that will used in internal, well, I've seen rules used in phishing campaigns where they just shuffle any email that says spam or virus or infected into the trash folder. So if they're infected and they are sending out emails to other people, people that email them back saying, hey, you've got a virus or whatever, those emails are automatically shuffled back into the trash.
Now, through a rule or just manually do that?
Oh, yep, through nice. A rule. Mm-hmm. So other things you need to check as well, you'll want to check all logins. Look for anomalous site logins. Sometimes it's as easy as being like, oh, this person always logs in from Ohio, and here's a weird login from the UK. Although attackers are frequently using VPNs. You can use something like IP quality score that'll call out VPN IP addresses and, you know, use some sort of integration or enrichment in your SIEM that'll pull out VPN IPs. You're going to want to look at items in SharePoint and OneDrive. There are logs in SharePoint that'll tell you if somebody accessed a item, and it'll also tell you the IP address that accessed the item. So you can, once you figure out what the suspicious IP addresses are, you can check to see what was accessed. You can also check in the Office 365 management logs for email rules set or other email application settings changed. It'll even tell you which emails were sent by those IP addresses, which is useful because sometimes it's really obvious which phishing emails were sent, and sometimes it's a little more subtle. And finally, you should also look at chats sent. I've definitely seen that in the past where when someone takes over an account, people will message them saying, hey, I just got this email from you. Are you sure this is legit? And they're like, oh, yeah, open it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
But one of the other things, you know, we talked about how their numbers seem odd. So the or are not exactly representative as you would expect it. But they mentioned that, you know, there's a 478% increase, but as it relates to the percentage of the types of emails received, it seems to have gone down from 2021. So in 2021, the percentage of total malicious emails seen by CoFence was 67% credential phishing. But in 2022, it was only 61% of the total number of malicious emails they've seen. So it's like the volume has increased, but the percentage of them, which are credential harvesting, are smaller or fewer.
Yeah, I don't know about their numbers. Like you talk about that, looks like it went down. They said that credential phishing went up 478%. I don't think credential phishing like quintupled over a year. I think, again, this is related to their customers. I think they onboarded enough customers that it went up.
Yeah, like I said, it's a total volume versus a relational amount. Because if you were to look at the 61 to 67%, you'd think that attackers are actually deviating from sending out credential emails in favor of the threat unavailable, whatever that is, which increased, or BEC, which also increased by 3%.
So threat unavailable is something that bears all the hallmarks of being malicious, but when they went there, they weren't able to load the page. So that may be because it's a different, you know, geolocation, or it was up and then it was brought down. But, you know, when you look at the email and you look at who it's from, you're like, oh no, this has to be malicious.
Mm-hmm. So those are likely malicious.
Yeah.
But not proven malicious. So that might be another interesting indicator then, because that could indicate a couple of things. Like you said, maybe they're being more careful with the emails that they send out to regionalize them, or maybe there's something else going on here that's more interesting. I think the change in percentages, I think, is more interesting than the 478%. I think that tells me more about the ecosystem of the threat environment than the 478% increase in the total volume of emails received.
Yeah, that makes sense. And frankly, to find a lot of those, like these are the ones where your SOC will look at it and they'll be like, I don't know, I can't tell. And to actually figure them out, you have to do some pretty reasonably serious investigation. You need a tool like URL Scan, like a paid version of it, where they have a, where you can load the URL via different proxies in different countries. And then what you can do is you can try to load that page on 20 different proxies in 20 different countries and look and determine if it came up differently.
Right.
Yeah.
And And depending on the volume of messages you're talking about, it may be just a better use of people's time. Just say, all right, malicious, move on, versus doing a whole in-depth investigation, depending on the report.
Yeah.
All right. The next thing in the top five was Emotet and QuakeBot as they relate to the top malware families. And they equate the malware families together through five indicators: information stealing, keylogging, remote access, loader capabilities, and backdoor controls.
How is backdoor controls different than remote access? I don't know the answer to that because I haven't looked it up, but now I'm curious.
I'm not sure. I mean, just looking at the face of it, I would think that backdoor controls are an actual backdoor install and remote access is using built-in capabilities.
Because we have seen that using like RDP or something else.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, they don't really describe it in here that I can see.
All right. And then the next one on the list, our favorite, BEC, continues to be a top cybercrime for the eighth year in a row.
Number one.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, we talked about this before, that BEC is in the billions, whereas ransomware is still in the millions. So, you know, that's still minor league stuff.
Yeah, they need to get their numbers up.
Yeah, I'm not trying
always
hard.
Be ransoming. So the overall procedure they do for these is they get those stolen creds, they go into the mailboxes, and then they man in the middle the money-related emails. They will frequently set up forwarding rules because, you know, when you log into when you break into someone's account, they may not be in the middle of any kind of transaction right then. But if you set up a forwarding rule and get those invoice related ones later, you can jump in.
Yeah. I was thinking about that always be ransoming. It should be ABC. Always be compromising.
Always be compromising. Yeah. Fine. So there's a couple of things. Well, I'm not going to talk about the setup forwarding, the blocking forwarding rules in MFA because we talk about those a little bit later.
Yeah, but one thing they mention in here that I want to highlight is payroll diversion attacks as part of BEC. Because HR system logging is terrible, like uniformly terrible, as far as being able to get accurate logs and logging from the HR system or to monitor what's going on in there.
Well, and even more so, like the HR folks typically don't monitor or have anything about like when somebody requests a change. Like it's all frequently done via email.
Yeah, versus like a ticketing system or something like that, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Someone emails someone changes something, and then you only find out about it a couple months later when someone's like, my bank account's getting awful low. I guess it depends on how well they track their bank account and, you know, how much extra money they have in it. Maybe when they start bouncing checks, they're like, something's wrong here.
Well, that's something else. You know, I was thinking about this because I've been reading a bunch of Deming lately, where even if you had, you know, if you had good HR logging and the HR systems are not being compromised where people are going in and making a bunch of changes to the direct deposits, but if you took when those things happen and threw them into a control chart, you might be able to see spikes or changes into stuff around when there are possible deviations or possible changes to people's bank accounts for that.
Yeah. Yeah, that might be interesting. Alert if there's a whole bunch of changes all at once.
Right. Or there's more. See, you could say that with a control chart, you could say that the standard deviation from a control chart is, you know, more than one, less than 10. But if you have you know, 15 requests to change bank accounts in 1 month, then that's a deviation from the norm. And maybe you want to go and review all of those to make sure they were legitimate changes, because that 15 is way outside the norm for a month on the number of times or the number of employees that change their payroll deductions. That's what I was thinking about.
That makes sense.
And of course, 81% of these emails come from free email services, which I'm not sure that if that's terribly useful, because I would imagine that most people are using free email services for their personal stuff. So you would expect them to contact organizations via those free services. So
I feel like it strongly depends on what type of interaction. I like, for example, invoice related stuff. I don't think you would expect to see that from free email services, but.
That's probably the way that I read it, because I read it in the context of the HR stuff, where employees emailing about their HR stuff.
You're right. Yeah.
And like I said, that could not be the context they wanted it to be read from. You know, it's just my interpretation of it, which may not be great. All right. And then the next section is Web3 technologies used in phishing campaigns has increased 341%. And we briefly touched on Web3 technologies before, which refers to a set of technologies intended to decentralize common internet and computing activity, like the interplanetary file system we talked about several months ago now.
Yeah. And my question on these is, I wonder who, if anyone, can remove a malicious site. If it's on ipfs.io, or theoretically it's decentralized and there's no one in control, does it just stay up forever?
I don't know. I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around this entirely, because resources aren't free. You know, so someone's got to be running the servers, keep them working, paying for the bandwidth and everything. So I have a hard time wrapping my head around exactly how this can be maintained over time if there's no ability to curate what's actually being maintained in that system. But they mentioned that, you know, most browsers still require a gateway to get to Web3 hosted content. So that's an opportunity for blocks to be put in place to prevent company access to those types of sites.
Yeah. Yep. They also included in here Telegram bots as exfiltration destinations increased by 100%, which I'm curious about, because Telegram chats apparently use a proprietary encryption protocol, but the API connections only use HTTPS. You may be able to detect the chats via an application aware firewall, or I don't know if it reaches out to something simple like api.telegram.com. I couldn't actually find the answer to that, although I'll admit I only searched for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, I don't know not enough about Telegram to say. My assumption would be that, you know, unless you're using Telegram, you should be able to prevent that on the network, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, I would hope that like a Palo Alto firewall or something can detect and shut that down.
Or any kind of CASB should be able to do that. All right, which brings us to section 2, which talks about big breaches, as opposed to big breaches, which have taken place over the last year.
I thought this section was kind of leave it.
Yeah, I just skimmed over it. And we'll just go through the list. But the first one they mentioned I wanted to briefly touch on, though, is Cisco, where an employee's personal Google account that contained passwords synced from their web browser was central to that compromise, which seems to indicate to me that they aren't using, or they have improperly configured their centralized browser management to prevent them from using the password storing feature in the browser and sharing that between their personal accounts and their corporate accounts.
How many companies are doing centralized browser management like that? That's not something I've seen at any company I've worked for.
Well, if you're using Edge as your browser, that's managed by AD. Google Chrome has an AD plugin, so you can manage Chrome from AD. Firefox does not, as far as I'm aware. So at least those two browsers can be centrally managed by the company to prevent that kind of activity from taking place. And apparently MFA fatigue was also part of that, which we touched on before.
Yeah.
Other stuff they mentioned in here is rural events being used as fishing lures, you know, no real big surprise there. People steal cryptocurrency, which is always shocking. They mentioned that there were actually fewer compromises in the energy sector in 2022 versus 2021. And then they get into email attachments, but I think we should talk about this a little bit more in depth. And
I guess.
Is they've seen, well, this might actually be useful as opposed to the fact that fishing lures are contextually based, you know, the big surprise there. But they've seen a 300% increase in HTML files being delivering malware. And they saw this ramp up in March when Microsoft announced that they were going to disable macros by default in its Office products. And what I thought was interesting about this is you can send an HTML email. Why would you attach an HTML file to that when you can do the same thing in the body of the email? So that kind of struck me as odd, unless most places or a lot of places are preventing incoming HTML emails.
We've talked about that before. Not, I don't think on the podcast, but about forcing email into text. And I know a lot of like the marketing group really hates that because all their fancy emails.
Yeah, I've tried to get that done at a couple of places and was shot down.
My only thought is maybe it dodges some of the email gateways. Maybe some of the email gateways are looking specifically for doc files or PDF files and they haven't configured HTML scanning. I don't know. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
But if you can put the maliciousness in the HTML in the body of the email, why attach it? That's what I'm failing to understand, I guess.
Yeah, I honestly couldn't tell you.
But they also mentioned the top domains that were abused to deliver phishing emails, with Adobe being number one, which I was kind of surprised. Google, which were followed by SharePoint and Google, which was quite a bit fewer. And then they mentioned that they were fake providers that threat actors created to share, you know, so that basically like a box or a Dropbox like clone effectively to trick people into going and downloading malware. And the one they mentioned was clickfunnels.com, which I'm unfamiliar with.
Yeah, I looked that up because I wanted to know more about it. But weirdly enough, it looked like a legitimate website. Like they had a careers page and a hiring page, although there was a ton of people complaining about getting junk mail from ClickFunnels. So,
yeah, block it was the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah.
But the top three email attachments was, of course, HTML and then PDF and HTML or HTM.
So I thought I'd seen elsewhere that ISO files were on the rise. I could have sworn there was some sort of report I recently saw, but that's not even on the top 10 list here.
Yes, I saw that in another report also, but not in here.
So I actually did
remember where I saw that.
Actually did a little hunt on ISO files and I was startled to find out they're actually highly used in a whole bunch of things. I was really shocked because I was like, oh, you know, ISO files, we can just alert on that. Nope, ISO files are used all over the place.
So after they break down the attachment, they jump into industry overviews, which they broke down into healthcare, which is apparently being hit pretty hard by BEC. And then financial services, utilities, professional, real estate, and then government.
Yeah, I did find it, and a couple of things in here interesting, that like healthcare had a lower resilience and was hit hard with BEC, but I've heard that doctors are notorious for risking things like MFA and any additional hurdle that may get in the way of something silly like saving lives.
Well, I think doctors are probably a lot like executives where they simply don't want to be bothered to take an extra step whenever they're doing whatever it is they're doing. I'm not disputing that they do have legitimate issues where, you know, if you're using an iPad in the operating room or whatever, it's kind of hard. You know, you don't have time to punch in your username and your password when it gets locked after 5 minutes when you're trying to look at something on the iPad when you're in the middle of surgery and stuff like that. So there are legitimate issues there for doctors. But in some instances, I think they're just being prima donnas. But of course, that's just my opinion. And then finally, they get down to how to enhance your email security. Number one being buy Cofense. Actually, they don't come out and say that specifically. They couched as, what was it, end-to-end email security. I think they said you need to get.
Yeah, and it had a small I had like a 10 or 15% improvement over using disjointed. So there was definitely an improvement, but.
Well, that could make all the difference.
Yeah, if you're reviewing all the submitted emails, reducing your, you know, email review by 10% seems pretty good.
And then they get into a checklist, which they broke down into BEC and vendor email compromise sections, credential phishing, attachments, and then malware. You know, kind of like they broke down the categories before with specific recommendations for each of those, which we're not going to dig into each one of those. But go and check out the report. You just skip down to page 23 and pull that out. You'll see what they had in there. This got me thinking about something Matt had pointed out to me, Auto GPT, where you could basically create an agent using GPT. So I wondered if you could create an AI agent and then deploy that as malware or send that as out malware or get that on someone's machine as malware to do what you needed to do and have it kind of learn how best to compromise and maybe traverse the enterprise, because it would almost be its own autonomous agent figuring things out for you rather than having to come up with and know all the compromise scenarios ahead of time and having them programmed into a malicious script.
Yeah, so I actually do see some use here. I don't know if I see the use as a malware agent, though. I think I see more around the generating phishing content. So the way that AutoGPT works, so right now, most people are working with AutoGPT in discrete questions, and it does remember state, and you can ask it, you know, further questions based on that. AutoGPT adds a database and through a Python script, which breaks down queries and then asks ChatGPT recursively, like how to accomplish those queries. And it adds memory as well so that you can save and ask future questions based on those saved things. So I saw someone pseudo coding out how at least one of these worked. I looked up for baby AGI myself. That was a fairly simple one. But it's you ask ChatGPT how to accomplish your goal, and then you ask it to break the answer down into discrete steps. You ingest those steps into the Python program, and then you turn each one of them into a separate query, and you save those steps. Then you feed the steps back into GPT as a query, and then, you know, if you think you need more, you ask it for more steps. And the problem is that at some point, someone has to action those steps, which ChatGPT really can't do at this point. But you can use other APIs to do so if it's electronic. So, for example, one of the ones that they've been asking folks about is how do I, you know, get rich as fast as possible? And ChatGPT keeps telling people to create online businesses or stuff like that. But there are some things that ChatGPT could do. You could write a script that would provide ChatGPT with a few details about your product, ask it to create a Twitter post about your product, then feed that into Twitter's API and just set it to do this 4 times a day. And maybe you've got like a bank of queries, so it doesn't come out looking very similar each time, and then you attach, you know, a variety of photos to it, or heck, use Midjourney to create the photos. Like, boom, now you've got marketing for basically automated and for free. So you could probably set it up to do emails in a similar way, create like marketing emails and stuff like that.
Yeah, I actually heard a statistic that said an email is worth 75 Twitter followers.
Interesting. I don't know. Although, so here's my thought on how you could do this for phishing. I wrote a big long post about this on LinkedIn, but like 10 people looked at it because, you know, I don't post a lot of stuff on LinkedIn. But you could write a script around this that says, you know, what company do I want to target? Then you can have ChatGPT go to the web page and develop open source intelligence on that target. You can have it go to LinkedIn and scrape all the users that work for that company. You can have it go to hunter.io and figure out the email address for that company and then plug all this stuff from phishing from LinkedIn into it to create your phishing list. You can have it generate a unique email for each person, like work its way down that email list, have it look up their LinkedIn and try to come up with an interesting phishing email. Now, admittedly, ChatGPT is a very broad. It probably won't come up with an effective phishing email, although I don't know. Maybe if you have a good prompt, it'll actually come up with something really effective.
Well, if you cast the net wider, you could get better results as well, because if you took their LinkedIn and looked at their Facebook and their Instagram or wherever, you're able to find them. And then you can make that a more targeted email that's increasing the likelihood for them to click.
Something I saw just today, somebody hooked up, I don't know how they, obviously it's more complicated than just they hooked up ChatGPT to an API, but they said that they had ChatGPT look up how to create a Docker container and stand it up, and then they fed the commands that ChatGPT gave them into Docker and it worked. So theoretically, you could set it up so that ChatGPT would set up an individualized landing page for each one of these phishing emails. Like there's all kinds of places that this would be really useful in terms of the phishing one. And I haven't found any good ones for the actual malware part yet, other than maybe creating new and hopefully undetectable code. But it's possible I just haven't thought about it deeply enough, or I'm too dumb. One of the, I mean, any of those could be true. There probably are ways.
Well, you could use it maybe not to develop the malware, but to choose the proper malware, the correct malware.
Ooh, what system they have and what patches are applied and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, that or start throwing malware at VirusTotal and find out which virus solution doesn't detect it as malware. And if that has a relationship to the company, you assume they're running that antivirus. So this is the malware that would get by their EV because VirusTotal says it can't be caught, and that's what they're using. So yeah, there's a lot of opportunity
here. That's a good one. Oh, also figure out
scruples.
You can profile them and figure out when the best time to use the computer is, because you don't want to use the computer while they're using it, or you may want to, or you may use it because, as Daniel Meisler said over and over again, the killer app right this second for ChatGPT is search. So you might be able to train the model on what's on their computer and ask, like, hey, are there any files related to invoices or payment on this or something like that?
Yeah, well, if you tie that into what they know about it from LinkedIn about their position.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, seems like there's all kinds of cool stuff you can do here. And this actually reading about this gave me ideas for projects. Right now, if you want to do OSINT on somebody, there are a bunch of scripts to do it, but you still kind of have to read through all the information. But since ChatGPT can read through and summarize for you, although sometimes with hilariously wrong results, I was watching some of these AutoGPT examples, and you could tell it, you could be like, hey, you know, pretend you're an open source threat intel investigator and you want to investigate this person or this group. How would you do it? Break down your steps and then feed that back into AutoGPT to recursively go and do all those searches and then take the contents from the searches back and turn each of those back into queries again. Like, that seems like an interesting development idea.
GPT all the way down.
Yep. And anyways, the last thing I saw using this, I don't know, we don't have to talk about this really, but I saw a really, have you heard of the overemployed theme or thing going on?
Is it where someone has two jobs?
Yeah.
And they're like only really working part-time at one, but they're
taking a full-time salary.
Full-time? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There was an interesting article I saw on Vice today where a bunch of these overemployed folks are talking about using ChatGPT to take on even more jobs. One person was talking about like four or five jobs, about how he's writing business plans and proposals and all this stuff using ChatGPT, and it takes him like an hour a day to do it. So that job's going to be automated away soon. I hope he's saving what he's making. Well, thanks for listening to the Scary Serengeti Podcast. Follow us on Twitter @SerengetiSec and subscribe and listen on your favorite podcast app.